It's nearly noon and time for the Midday Report. You're listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. Presently 57 degrees here atop Burrow Hill. We're looking for scattered showers today and tomorrow. Temperatures in the mid-50s in the daytime, mid-40s in the nighttime. And we can look for those kind of weather conditions to go on for the next week or so. Except Friday. We're having a sunny Friday. So take advantage of that if you can. And stories coming up. A new update to Kodiak's COVID count. The rollout of school openings has had a few COVID bumps. And we have another of our student essays. We have a high tide coming up at 3:20 this afternoon on the east side, an 8-foot tide. Over on the west side, you'll have a high tide coming up at 3:46, a 15.3-foot tide.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is campaigning in the key battleground state of North Carolina again today, where he named the port city of Wilmington a World War II heritage city. And he stayed true to his campaign talking points, including what he calls violent mobs.
If American warriors did not defeat fascism and oppression overseas only to watch our freedoms be trampled by violent mobs here at home, we stop those violent mobs very easily. All they have to do is say, please come in, Mr. President. We'll have it done in 1 hour.
Vice President Mike Pence is scheduled to visit North Carolina tomorrow. Joe Biden looked to refocus the message of his campaign on the coronavirus with remarks today focused on reopening the nation's schools. But as NPR's Juana Summers reports, Biden also faced questions about law enforcement issues, including the shooting of Jacob Blake.
Biden was asked about his planned trip to Kenosha, Wisconsin this week, despite some local leaders urging him not to. He said there have been overwhelming requests for him to come and that he wants to bring people together. He also was asked what he would do to end the violence.
First of all, I wouldn't incite violence. I'd condemn it when it occurred.
Biden said that he believed protesting and free speech are rights, but that engaging in violence in the name of protests is wrong and that those people should be held accountable. Juana Summers, NPR News, Wilmington, Delaware.
Meanwhile, Biden's campaign says it, along with the Democratic National Committee, has raised $364.5 million in August, a record-breaking amount. The campaign says $205 million came from smaller online donations. Republicans haven't announced their August totals yet. Russian officials are dismissing the announcement by the German government that Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was poisoned with a nerve agent known as Novichok. As NPR's Lucian Kim reports from Moscow, Navalny is in intensive care in a Berlin hospital where he was airlifted after falling ill on a trip to Serbia.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's spokesman is repeating the Kremlin's line that Siberian doctors who first treated Alexei Navalny did not find any poisonous agents in his body. The Russian Foreign Ministry said German officials and doctors were not cooperating with their Russian counterparts and suggested the West was seeking a new pretext for sanctions. Russia used a similar argument after the 2018 attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter in England, who were also poisoned by the Novichok nerve agent. The head of Navalny's anti-corruption foundation tweeted that only Russia's security agencies have access to Novichok, and Navalny's lawyer demanded Russian law enforcement open an investigation into attempted murder. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
Wall Street higher at the close, the Dow up 454 points, the Nasdaq up 116 points, the S&P 500 up 54 points. For the Dow, it's up more than 1.5%. You're listening to NPR News. A statue of a Confederate soldier that stood at the center of the Bentonville Square in Arkansas for more than a century was removed early this morning. As Ozana SciTech reports, the statue will be preserved under an agreement with its owners.
Yay!
A group of onlookers cheered as the statue of a Confederate soldier was removed from its pedestal on the Bentonville Square. The statue is owned by the Arkansas Division of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. The group recently reached an agreement with the Benton County Historical Society to have the statue restored and moved to a private park. Walmart's headquarters are in Bentonville, and over time, the city has become increasingly diverse. In the last 3 years, there have been numerous calls for the statue's removal, and it's been damaged several times. For NPR News, I'm Zuzana Sitek in Bentonville, Arkansas.
United Airlines has notified more than 16,000 employees that they could be laid off in October. The carrier says a drop in air travel demand, along with the federal bailout money running out, led to the decision. United and several other airlines took a $25 billion rescue package to pay salaries, and a condition of taking that money was to refrain from laying anyone off until October. Airlines have been asking Congress for another $25 billion to pay for salaries through next spring. Wall Street higher preliminary close numbers have the Dow and the S&P 500 both up more than 1.5%. The NASDAQ gained almost 1%. Crude oil prices down about 2.8%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years. DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
For the past 2 weeks, Kodiak's COVID-19 count has been at a standstill. But on Monday, there were 2 new reports of infection, and Tuesday, another 3 cases were added to the list, bringing the total number reported on Kodiak Island to 69. Among the 5 new cases, one is a Kodiak resident currently off-island, 2 are travel-related, and 2 appear to be a case of community transmission, which involved 2 members of the same family. Elsa DeHart, a Kodiak public health nurse, says there's no obvious source of transmission among the 2 family members, and it's also unclear which one was infected first.
The virus passes so fast and is so infectious that you can't always pinpoint that exact person.
DeHart says none of the 5 people who tested positive for the virus are critically ill. Some are showing symptoms. Others are asymptomatic.
Several of our cases from Alitak, from the south end of the island, that went to Anchorage to isolate were hospitalized, and one was hospitalized in the ICU. So that was pretty serious.
With school about to start next week, DeHart says there's heightened concern that these 5 new cases might be the leading edge of another outbreak, but that doesn't appear to be the case.
We're a little worried that something might really break loose, and it doesn't appear to have, so that is just a big relief for all of us.
DeHart says cases of community transmission have been rare on Kodiak Island and have been quickly contained. The majority of COVID-19 infections have involved non-residents. And just a reminder, the COVID-19 testing tent is now at a new location. It was at East Elementary School. It's been moved to the Bayside Fire Department on Razanoff Road. To get a test, you still need to get a referral from the Kodiak Area Native Association. CANA offers testing Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Dozens of students across the state have tested positive for the coronavirus over the past 2 weeks since school has started in Alaska. In the Mat-Su School District, 6 students have tested positive for the coronavirus at 4 different schools. That's the largest district in the state to reopen for in-person classes. 3 schools are currently closed for cleaning and contact tracing. Coronavirus cases in students have also been reported in Fairbanks and Nome schools, at Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka, and at the McLaughlin Youth Detention Center in Anchorage, where an outbreak there has grown to 15 students. Dr. Liz Olson, a state public health official, says constant communication between schools and parents can help schools take quick action when a positive case arises.
Most kids just have very, very mild symptoms with COVID-19, fortunately. But the tricky thing with that is that, you know, both kids and adults can have symptoms that they think are too mild COVID-19, but there really isn't any of those symptoms on that list that are too mild to be COVID-19.
Olson says that even an inkling of a COVID-19 symptom is a reason to stay home and get tested. She also says given how the virus is spreading in the larger community, she expects to see more students pop up with cases in coming weeks. Alaska has been referred to as one big community where, despite vast distances, it sometimes seems that people all know each other. That is especially so when a disaster or misfortune befalls someone. Friends and acquaintances from all parts are reminded of their connection to each other. A recent boating accident near the Kuskokwim River village of Kalskag in western Alaska is an example. On Friday, August 30th, the Alaska State Trooper Online Dispatch reported that a boat had capsized on the Kuskokwim between Aniak and Kalskag, killing a man and his wife, Glenn and Natasha Kamaroff. The third person on board survived. What the report didn't say is that Glenn Kamaroff was a wildlife fighter, one of many rural residents who spend their summers flying into remote hotspots to battle blazes. Kamaroff was one of 100 or so firefighters who flew in to subdue the massive Chiniak Twin Creeks fire 5 years ago.
Glenn Kamaroff was the crew boss for the Kalskag fire crew.
That's Chiniak resident and photographer Betty O'Dell, who said she got to know Kamaroff while photographing the blaze.
I was so glad that I got to spend time with some of the fire crews, and the Kalskag crew was the one I spent the most time with. And when I saw in the news, in an article in the Daily News early one morning, I saw the headline of, you know, a boat capsized in the Kuskokwim River, and people were from Kalskag, and you know, I just kind of froze, and I opened the article and read it. I was like, oh no, there it was, this sad story. He and his wife had died. It made me cry. I felt really bad about that.
O'Dell said each morning of the fire, the many different fire crews gathered to get instructions on how they would spend their next 12 hours in the fire zone. Kamaroff, as crew boss, led his group out to battle the burning trees of Chiniak.
He would give them direction, and they would all file away, you know, one after the other in a line, and they would head off through the brush and then under the trees, and off they would go, and you know, and then they would be out for like 12 hours, and then they come walking back into the camp at the end of the day, you know, early evening. And I was so glad that I got to spend time with some of the fire crews.
Ironically, Kamaroff drowned almost exactly 5 years to the day from when he was in Kodiak. The Twin Creek fire started during a storm of August 27, 2015. The fire spread rapidly with winds that night gusting to 50 miles per hour. The blaze destroyed one home and the library, but spared the nearby Chiniak school. This week's Talk of the Rock program is a rebroadcast of the one from last year, marking the fourth anniversary of the blaze. Several Chiniak residents, including O'Dell, shared their memories of the massive blaze, which was clearly seen from town as towering flames reached into the sky. You can listen to that Talk of the Rock by going to KMXT's website, kmxt.org. This summer, seven Kodiak students took part in a video workshop called Kodiak Culture and COVID-19. Each student has produced a short video documenting their personal pandemic journey to eventually become part of the Kodiak History Museum exhibit next spring. As the young interns worked on their videos, they also wrote and recorded essays to share with KMXT. Today on our ongoing series of stories, we feature Jude Villarroya. He's only in the sixth grade, but he already has his own YouTube channel, Jude Loves Food, in which he shares his love of food, travel, and adventure with a generous helping of humor. In this essay, Jude gives us a slice of life during the COVID quarantine.
Before this pandemic, when everything was fine and normal, on a weekend, I would wake up at 8 a.m. and go on my phone for an hour to check my notifications and explore TikTok. After that, I would go to the kitchen and see what my mom made for breakfast. And if she hadn't made anything, I would glaze Nutella all over the two pieces of toast I made. Then I would watch TV, mostly a lot of anime. I would spend at least 2 hours on TV, and then I would go outside and play around with my friends. We would hang out, doing our thing, like going to the park and playing games. This was just a normal day in my pre-COVID life. Then this worldwide virus hit us. It could kill people. It took over the world. There were a lot of precautions, like having to wear a mask everywhere, avoiding crowds, and if traveling, you have to quarantine for 14 days. I was feeling sad because my parents were rarely letting me go outside, and it's been kinda tough in a day in the life in quarantine. All day, I would binge Netflix, try to motivate myself to do videos on my YouTube channel, Jude Likes Food, and take long naps. Now, after a few months of COVID, I've gotten used to this new lifestyle. I've been bringing my mask everywhere I go just in case. I have been going outside, but I'm still staying away from people the best I can. I'm realizing that life goes on, even if it's changed, and that, as people, we have the power to adapt to great change.
That was Jude Villarroya, one of the interns in Kodiak Culture and COVID-19 Virtual Documentary Internship Program. There will be a virtual screening of the videos the students produced tomorrow, and you can take place via Zoom. Just go to kmxt.org, where you can hear all of those student essays, and you'll also find instructions on how you can access the live screening of the videos via Zoom this Thursday. That's tomorrow. The multinational company that operates the massive Red Dog mine in northwest Alaska says it's had to spend nearly $20 million to handle water problems created by thawing permafrost. As Nat Herz with the Alaska's Energy Desk found, the region is warming three times faster than the global average, and that comes with a cost.
To understand what's happening at the Red Dog mine, we're actually going to start downstream at the Wolick River and Calicruk Creek. That's where the Alaska Department of Fish and Game does annual fish counts, or at least it did until the summer of 2019. Audra Brassey is part of the team that works on the project for Fish and Game. She says something was happening in the water that made the fish too hard to see.
We always do a fall survey. We're up there counting the Dolly Varden and the chum that are coming in the fall. We were unsuccessful because it was so turbid. You could see some fish, but you couldn't get a complete count. So that's what made it unusual.
Upstream at the mine, things have been changing too. For decades, Red Dog has discharged its wastewater out of a reservoir and into a nearby creek, but it's only allowed to do that when the creek's natural levels of dissolved minerals are below a certain threshold. The reservoir can only hold so much water, but that had never been a problem before the summer of 2019, according to Red Dog's community and public relations manager, Wayne Hall.
In 30 years of Red Dog operation, this is the first time that we've ever seen background levels in the creeks at the point where it precluded us from discharging.
Red Dog officials say they think the minerals in the water are coming from thawing permafrost and increased precipitation. Permafrost expert Vladimir Romanovsky says scientists are seeing the same thing. During the summer, soils are thawing deeper and deeper down, and during the winter, it's freezing at shallower levels. Romanovsky, a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says that's allowing water to move more easily through the unfrozen layer.
This water can bring more sediments to the creeks and streams and rivers. So I think that's the natural process which is happening because of steadily warming climate and deeper and deeper thawing permafrost.
Red Dog is one of the world's largest zinc mines, and it's had to spend about $19 million on projects to keep the reservoir from getting too full. Over the past year, it's sucked water out of the reservoir and frozen it into an ice field. It's accelerated a project to raise the height of the reservoir's dam, and it's even pumped hundreds of millions of gallons of reservoir water into its active mining pit, which has flooded the bottom. Here's how Dale Anders with Teck, the Canadian company that operates the mine, described it in a call with investors last month.
When we have to store water in our pit, it does restrict us from accessing the higher grade at the bottom of the pit, and we're having to mine lower grades towards the top of the pit.
Just last week, Red Dog finished building a new reverse osmosis treatment system, which has allowed it to restart pumping from the reservoir into the nearby creek. Meanwhile, global warming is also hitting resource infrastructure on the North Slope, where oil companies are paying for technologies to extend the shortening winter ice road season, and a flood last year hit the Trans-Alaska pipeline with $10 million in repairs. Alaska faces billions of dollars in public infrastructure-related costs due to global warming, scientists predict. But Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration has downplayed impacts and disbanded a state climate change response commission. For its part, Teck, the company that operates Red Dog, says it plans to make its operations carbon neutral by 2050. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Hurst.
Governor Mike Dunleavy declined to answer a question about when and what he knew about inappropriate text messages sent by former Attorney General Kevin Clarkson to a younger female state worker. The governor says he's limited by state law.
That issue was dealt with according to law, and there are statutes that allow and prohibit certain comments on that.
Clarkson resigned last week after the texts became public. The Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica reported that Clarkson sent 558 texts to the employee on her personal phone in March. In the texts, Clarkson asked the woman to come to his house at least 18 times. In the written statement announcing the resignation, Dunleavy said Clarkson, quote, admitted to conduct in the workplace that did not live up to our high expectations, unquote, which he described as deeply disappointing. It's not clear when Dunleavy became aware of the texts. They stopped after the woman sent Clarkson a message in early April asking him to respect personal boundaries. Clarkson began a leave of absence August 1st that was scheduled to last a month. He resigned a week before the leave was to end. During a Tuesday press conference, Dunleavy referred a question by the Alaska's news sources Daniela Riviera to his office.
They'll screen it through our department of law to make sure that the answers that you're given are in conjunction with allowable applicable law to actually talk about that issue.
The governor's appointee to fill the attorney general's job will be subject to confirmation by the legislature.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way. 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Salmon season is winding down across the state. Some updates after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute wants industry members to help guide programs that increase the value of Alaska seafood. Learn more and apply at alaskaseafood.org.
Alaska's salmon season is winding down, with the total statewide catch so far topping 107 million fish. That's more than 80% of the preseason forecast of nearly 133 million salmon. Over the next few weeks, only about 3% of any remaining catches should occur based on historical data. Some late season highlights show sockeyes trickled into Kodiak and Alaska Peninsula nets over the week, where about 180,000 more were taken. That brings Alaska's total sockeye catch to over 45 million reds, roughly 95% of what state managers projected. More than 39 million came from Bristol Bay. Pinks are Alaska's bread and butter fish, and catches of over 55 million are more than 90% on target for projections. Surprisingly strong catches at Kodiak were set to top 21 million, beating out Prince William Sound as top pink salmon producer, at least for now. Kodiak's catch is 9 million humpies ahead of its forecast. To the contrary, pink salmon fishing at Southeast Alaska, which wrapped up on August 20th, produced just 5.4 million fish, the lowest since 1976 and the fifth lowest since statehood. Chums also were a bust at Southeast, with catches barely topping 2 million fish, the lowest harvest since 1990. In fact, chum salmon runs were dismal in every region of Alaska. Total catches nearing 5.7 million are down nearly 70% from last year and the five-year average. Chinook catches of 211,000 are off by about 25% from last year. Our salmon updates are compiled by the McDowell Group for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Fish Radio is supported in part by Joy Crafts, specializing in marine safety equipment. U.S. Coast Guard approved AMSI instruction for commercial fishing vessel safety procedures and drills, serving Kodiak for over 25 years. 486-6293 at 445 Shahafka Circle.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 36, date issued August 31st at 10 a.m. There will be a 102-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, September 1st, until 6 p.m. Saturday, September 5th, in the following areas: in the Central, North Cape, Sheraton Bay, Kajuyak Bay, Terror Bay, and Inner Ugandic Bay sections of the Northwest Kodiak District; the Humpy Dead Man, Cape Alitak, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District; the Eastside Kodiak District, and the Northeast Kodiak District. There will be a 78-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, September 1st, until 6 p.m. Friday, September 4th, in the following areas: in the Outer Ayakulik section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Afognak District, except for the Outer Katoy Bay and Iziut Bay sections remain open until further notice, and the Mainland District. As previously announced, the following areas remain open until further notice: the Outer Katoy Bay and Iziut Bay sections of the Afognak District, and until further notice in that portion of the Northwest and Southwest Kodiak District south of latitude of Cape Kuliuk, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart, detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Well, you've made it to Wednesday and to September. It's Wednesday, September 2nd. The year 2020. We're looking at sort of rainy, drizzly conditions, a lot like what you're looking at right now if you go look outside, for the next 6 days or so at least, except on Friday, where they're calling for sunny skies. So take advantage of that Friday if you can. For mariners, we have light winds going all around the island until Friday night when they're expected to pick up, and Saturday we're looking for small craft advisory force winds and for east winds to go to 25 knots in Chiniak Bay and seas to build to 9 feet in Chiniak Bay on Saturday. Photographers, KMXT is looking for photo submissions for the 2021 Kodiak Moments calendar. Choose your favorite 5 and submit them to KMXT for consideration. If your photo or photos are chosen, you'll get some KMXT bling and calendars to give out to your friends. Photos must be taken in the Kodiak Island Archipelago and must be horizontal shots. We always end up short on those shots for winter and spring, so don't forget to include one or two of those. Enter your digital images to pam@kmxt.org before 5 p.m. Monday, September 8th. Or you can call us for more information at 486-3181. Alaska Natives who served in the military between 1964 and 1971 may be eligible to apply for up to 160 acres of free federal land beginning as early as November. Family members of deceased eligible veterans may be eligible too and will need a personal representative appointed by the Alaska State Court. Call the Bureau of Land Management for questions about this. That number, 907-271-5998, or you can visit the Bureau of Land Management's Alaska website. COVID-19 relief grants are available to small businesses and commercial fishers in the Kodiak region. If you'd like to know what you qualify for quickly and accurately, just visit the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference's website. They have free one-stop shopping to connect you with support, including a hotline to walk you through it. Just go to swamc.org, that's swamc.org, to get started. Did you know that parents who play an active role in their early child development build a strong foundation for lifelong learning? Learn what you can do by enrolling in Parents as Teachers for free. Kodiak Parents as Teachers has openings for families with children prenatal to 3 years of age providing services that are free to families, including personalized in-home visits, group socials, and developmental screenings. Call or text Heather at 539-5443.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.